following is Andy Fitzgerald's talk, Responsive Information Architectures, from the 2014 Information Architecture Summit. The 2014 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by UIE's All You Can Learn. Stay tuned after the podcast for more information about All You Can Learn.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. It's great to see you all. So, I want to start here. I want to start with the page and the practice of writing that comes with the page. Together, these two things, revolutionary technologies, have allowed us as a species to accomplish amazing things, and terrible things, but also amazing things. And with writing combined, some have argued successfully in my book that they've actually changed the way our brains work. They've changed the way we think. And the potential in technologies to deeply affect how we exist in the world is exciting stuff. Like other technologies, however, the page comes with both opportunities and constraints. So some of the constraints of the page, fairly obvious, it's fixed. Once it's printed, you can't do much with it. Not a lot of diversity in pages. We get color, we get size, but they're still pretty page-like. And we interact with all of them in more or less the same way. And they don't often interact back much. So they become airplanes or WADs. Now, for pages, this is fine. But it becomes a problem when we map these constraints onto other kinds of technologies. So there's been lots of talk already today at the summit and the preceding days about mobile and what that means for IA. Now, we know that these devices are coming onto the market in greater numbers and variety every day. And we know that they consistently trump the page-like assumptions and constraints that we bring to them. We also know that mobile is only one piece of the information ecology we design for at present. Scott Jensen uses a metaphor to describe this larger device landscape. And he talks about this ecology is composed of bears, bats, and bees. The bears are the devices that we have on our desks and in our pockets. They have rich displays. They're powerful. They're versatile. Lots of capability. The bats are the smart objects that focus on a single task, have more limited display capability. And then the bees, finally, are the inexpensive, ubiquitous sensors that send data back from the wider network. Now, all of these create information flows that need to be designed to be intelligible for our end users. Now, I really like this image of this futuristic, bucolic technosphere. But when I think about bears, bats, and bees in the connected environment, or bears, bats, and bees in the connected home in my living room, I usually think of something closer to this. It's a situation that's not so much an Internet of Things as a zoological horror show. Right? It's one that, as IAs, at least in part, it's up to us to deal with. Right? How to tame this horde of information. Now, the response from the design community on how to avoid this domestic catastrophe has been pretty clear. Sarah Wachter-Betcher puts it like this. The best we can all do is focus our limited stock of human care and attention toward designing systems, not obsessing over individual pages and platforms. And this question of designing systems has taken a lot of forms. So when we were designing for the desktop, we pretty quickly figured out, especially with mobile, that that's bad. And then we started doing mobile first. Then we started figuring out how fluid and slippery content was, and we started moving into content first. Right, which I kind of think is where we still are now, is that content first place. What this looks like is still taking shape. So for today, my purpose, I'd like to explore what content first can look like from a practical IA perspective. As some of you know, I've written recently on how we deal with this kind of ecosystem. I've written at a very conceptual level, sort of like thinking in the big, broad terms we like to think of here. So my presentation today will deal with some of those broad level things, but also deal with some very concrete level things. And the concrete level things I would like to submit to you, not as solutions, but as thinking exercises, places we can poke holes in our assumptions, and hopefully ways that we can start to reframe the questions that we bring to this space. So it's with this goal in mind that I'd like to present you with a reading of one way we might design IAs for system, a kind of responsive information architecture. In a nutshell, I define this as an information design strategy that allows for the expression of specific meaning across multiple and independent contexts. The way I've been practicing this recently in the agency that I work for is made up of four key pieces. The first is a rich understanding of the information ecology, a content-driven set of guidelines for interaction design choices, articulated information structures based on multiple modes of meaning-making. And articulation is a word that I'm going to use a lot today. And by it, I mean expression of our ideas fluently and coherently. And then finally, the last piece here is an embrace of ambiguity as a strategy for negotiating the connected environment. I'm going to go through these four ideas and four basic steps. I first want to look at responsive web design. My interest there is in order to pull out the kinds of insights that responsive web design, who has really hit this space head on, the insights that they've brought to that, and see how we can apply that to IA. I'll also look at meaning-making, and meaning-making as an embodied ecological phenomenon. We'll look at information architecture as we've practiced it up until now, and then I'll give an example of what a responsive information architecture as an emergent practice for negotiating cross-channel experiences in the connected environment might look like. So let's start here with responsive web design. Ethan Marcotte, who literally wrote the book Responsive Web Design in 2011, writes that the goal of responsive web design is to embrace the flexibility inherent to the web without surrendering the control we require as designers. Just like the constraints on information imposed by the page, many of the constraints from the web are constraints that we've imposed ourselves. So table layouts, spacer gifs, flash, m.dot signs. None of this is inherent in the web. One of Marcotte's key recommendations for designing for a responsive web is the responsive grid. So the responsive grid is pretty easy in general. You break your content into chunks and then assign them a certain width on the page within rows. As your screen size changes, you can reorganize those widths and then stack them vertically. Right? I'm breezing over this because I'm assuming that the 99 of you are like, yeah, Andy, we got it. Right? And you know it because every time you open a website on a phone, you see, well, a responsive website on a phone, you'll see this happening. So we can take skinnyties.com, for example. We have our large bar there across the top, and then our three content chunks. We look at that on a phone, and we can see that everything's taken up the full width of the page. What's interesting is when we start to move up the levels of abstraction of how responsive web design works and the kind of models that are behind it. So if we look at the underlying structure of that responsive grid, you can see that it's made up of 12 columns. Right? And the code in the website tells that first chunk, hey, on a desktop, you're going to be 12 columns wide. Tells the second chunk, you're going to be 6 columns wide. The third and fourth reach 3 columns. On the mobile view, the code says, hey, we're on a smaller screen. Everybody's 12 columns wide. Right? So they stack. When we abstract this up another level, we can see that in designing the grid, the developer actually has to conceptually map out all of the possible columns and all of the possible column combinations. Now, you would never see this many columns on an actual website, but this is the underlying structure that makes the gridded display we saw earlier possible. If we abstract up one more level, we can see that what we view in the end as an orderly, tidy grid of boxes is actually an exhaustive set of instructions built into the website's CSS. And it's these declarations that create the possibility of a structure that we can easily recognize. Now, by moving this high up into the design process conceptually, we can see how responsive web design acts as a shim between the technical browser requirements and the perceptual requirements of the human user. And that's the thing that I want to pull out of this technique. That's the thing that's interesting for me, that the responsive grid is a model that allows us to write the rules necessary to effectively articulate an instance in the system. The only time you see the columns in the grid laid out like I'm showing them here is when someone's trying to explain the model. The model's for us, for the designers, not for the users. What the users see is content that makes sense that's been tuned to their perception. So the next question is, how does this concept of models, rules, and articulation work when we're talking about how people process information? To dig into that, let's look more closely at how people make meaning. In the brilliant and often quoted Design Quarterly essay, Hats, Richard Saul Wurman writes that you can only understand something relative to something you already understand. Like much of what Wurman says, simple statement, profound consequences. Linguist and semiotician Charles Sanders Peirce identifies three ways that people signify or make meaning from symbols. He calls these modes of signification. The first of these is perhaps the most straightforward, just symbolic. In this case, the signifier does not resemble the signified. It's arbitrary and conventional. The classic example here is the thing tree and the word tree. So the word tree is our signifier, the thing tree is our signified. We could just as easily call this a crocodile, and as long as we all agreed that this was a crocodile, we could use it exactly the same way. Now, text is, in this kind of text, this kind of arbitrary signification, is still what much of the web is made up of. HTML is literally a language for marking up a certain kind of text. Text still remains a large part of how we understand the world as well. But two major factors are disrupting this. One is mobile, which is variable in context, and the other is the connected environment, which goes beyond textuality and moves into embodiment. Both of these are intertwined, and they both use methods of meaning making that go well beyond the text. So while this kind of signification will continue to be important in the way we understand the world and the way we move forward, I argue that we need to look at other ways that we make meaning if we're going to adequately design for this environment. So let's look at a couple more. The indexical mode definition here is a case where the signifier is directly connected to the signified. So classic examples, smoke signifies fire, fever signifies infection, a knock signifies a visitor, handwriting signifies the writer. There have recently been some interesting examples that have cropped up in the Internet of Things of the indexical mode. This is the good night lamp. The good night lamp is an internet-connected lamp that has a very simple purpose. It allows people separated by distance or circumstance to remain connected. The way it works is the big lamp, it's shaped like a house, of course, it's got a button in the chimney, you turn the button on, the lamp goes on. The person with whom you're trying to remain more connected, the separated loved one, if you will, has one of these little houses, right, wherever it is that they are. You turn your lamp on, their lamp goes on. The scenario is, you come home, you turn your lamp on, you go about your whatever it is that you do in your home, and then you go to bed, you turn the lamp back off. It's a really simple idea, but there's something clever going on here. And the something clever works on the indexical mode. It's that when the lights are on in the house, somebody's home. Now, it seems really simple, almost stupid, right? But if you think about people who are away from home or are separated from loved ones, right, then you get all the things that are wrapped up not in the word home, but the concept home. And that this uses its shape, its form, and those kinds of connections to signify at a much deeper level, at an emotional level. And we can see why this is the case when we compare it to other ways that you could do this. So, for instance, you could send a text message, hey, I'm home, text again, hey, I'm going to bed. Nowhere near the same kind of connection. You could also get closer to something like this and have a little switch, right, that turned on a blinking LED that blinked for the whole time you were home. And it blinked in your loved one's house, too, until you went to bed, and then it went off. And they would probably grow to hate you, right? So my point here is that this mode of signification moves the connection between the signifier and the signified deeper into our embodied, into our emotional experience. Our last mode goes even deeper still. So this is the iconic mode. In this case, the signifier is perceived as resembling or imitating the signified. Semiotician Daniel Chandler writes that iconic signifiers seem to present reality more directly than symbolic signs. So I'm going to break my pattern of showing you a positive example here and show you a negative example first. Because when we think icons in this practice, we usually think about something like this. Right, this is the icon, of course, for save. Right, the notorious icon for save, because nobody saves on these anymore, right, and haven't for years. Right, many people that would press this icon have not even seen this physical thing. Now, we can even take something that's a little less notorious, these icons, for instance. There's still no direct connection to the signified. At one time, with a reel-to-reel tape machine, there might have been something indexical here. But this is still operating on the symbolic mode. It's an arbitrary connection between the thing and the thing that it's standing for. Iconic signification in the linguistic, semiotic sense operates at a much more fundamental level of meaning-making. This image, for instance, signifies to us much more clearly and much more directly than any of the preceding examples. It's just an outlet, right? But it signifies a concept, the face, and emotion, happiness, to us pretty directly. And it's because it resonates with the way that we perceive the world. It has the salient characteristics of a face. In contrast, compare this with the kinds of outlets I have in my garden. We still see a face, but it's pretty appalled, right? Every time I open the little door now to go plug something in outside, I'm confronted with this quandary. Now, some of this is cultural and some of it's learned, but more than anything, iconic signifiers work because they appeal to a much deeper level of meaning-making. Louise Barrett writes that this innate bias may not be for faces as such, but for the particular kind of geometric configuration that faces present. The face is a pattern that we recognize because of the way our brains are wired. This is the thing that we understand in order to understand something else. Faces are, of course, far from the only patterns that we recognize. Edward Tufte has made a pretty good career of fine-tuning and optimizing the patterns that we use to make meaning. So here Tufte redesigns a before and after of a New York train timetable. We can see in the corner up there is the before, and then the after is this thing that you see in the foreground. Tufte removes what he calls the chart junk, the grids, the lines, the repetition. In terms of the responsive web model we were looking at before, this is the model that we use to put these together, but it's not the model that we use to understand it. It's not what appeals to our perceptions. What's left in the lower version are the salient characteristics. So in this case, it's the groupings, the associations, and the continuities that make sense to us. These two concepts of differentiating between the model and what the model does in a system and pulling out these salient characteristics of signification are the things that I want to, in this next section, apply in thinking about IA and how that leads to a responsive IA. So at last year's IA summit, Dan Klein and the very smart folks over at the Understanding Group put together a poster called The Nature of Information Architecture. In the TUG model, IA has three main parts. It has ontology, or particular meaning, what Dan Klein has in other cases referred to as what we mean when we say what we say. I want to add one more layer onto this and say that it's also the argument. It's how we encourage users to think about the content or functionality we're offering. The second piece of the TUG model is the arrangement of the parts, or the arrangement of meaning in and across contexts. In terms of the argument, this is how the pieces of the argument fit together. It's a method of arrangement conceived to create a particular kind of understanding. Now, the last piece of the TUG model is choreography, which are rules for interaction among the parts. The appropriate unfolding, as Dan has put it. In my argument about arguments, I'll argue that choreography must respond to context in order to be effective. And I'm going to look at why that's the case. To do that, I want to turn this model not quite on its head, but sideways, and add some stuff to it. The first of these is content, right? It's all that it's possible to say about a thing. This is the stock from which we distill our particular meaning, derive our ontology. From there, we arrange the parts in taxonomy, and then we, of course, create the appropriate unfolding in choreography. And then, of course, we all know that the end goal of IA is to make this intelligible to our users. Intelligible content, however, is not our only goal. The reason that most of us have jobs is because it actually matters how that understanding happens. This is what we often refer to as the user experience of a particular design or implementation. But we can be more precise and call it qualia. Now, qualia is an idea that's been around for a while, but it helps hone in on something very particular that I want to look at in this model. Qualia is a description of the subjective or qualitative properties of an experience. So qualia can be anxiety, frustration, anger, or fear, or it can be satisfaction, accomplishment, delight, or euphoria. And it won't be the same for every site or every experience. SkinnyTies.com, for instance, is whimsical, spontaneous, self-assured. The qualia for CancerCareAlliance.org is going to be quite different. Right? It has to be to meet its goals. So let's look at an example of when qualia is effective. This is a site for Warby Parker. Warby Parker is a designer and manufacturer of custom eyeglass frames and monocles. They have an online sales portal, virtual try-ons. In addition to good-looking frames, they also have a philanthropic mission. For every pair of frames they sell, they donate a pair to someone in need. And the website tells this story in a compelling and effective way. As the site unfolds, we get the narrative around how Warby Parker is building a company to do good. And the quality we get here is trust, admiration, and generosity. Now, the generosity here isn't my sense that they're generous, but it's me being generous to them. The quality is something that I feel. I want them to succeed. They've gotten me on board. Now, the reason that Warby Parker is interesting to me is that, of course, saw the site, liked what they were doing, ordered a pair of glasses to do some try on, could not find anything that worked. Like, their product failed me. But I was still a fan. I told my friends about it. I'm like, oh, you want glasses? You try Warby Parker. They didn't fit me. Right? But I wanted them to fit someone because they had gotten me on board. I became an advocate even though I wasn't a customer. If you're doing work for e-commerce sites or anybody that has anything to sell, that's huge to make your non-customers advocate for you. Now, what I want to argue is that this introduces an additional element into our extended model of IA, the medium, in this case, a device. And here, I've represented the device as a prism. We can see why the medium is a prism by examining what happens when that medium changes. So let's take the same site we just looked at, Warby Parker, and look at it on my phone. So we start off with a pretty well choreographed M dot view, right, that moves over into a fluid view of what's pretty clearly a desktop page, and then finally defaults into a fixed width desktop page. And it actually doesn't scale down. You have to pan around, right, to move it to see what's going on. Now, I don't say this to pan Warby Parker, right? Not at all. I'm still a total fan. I think they're doing great things and better at this than most. But the quality here is different. The story is the same. And if I work hard enough, I can get the story out. But I'm less receptive to it. And we all know how hard users are willing to work, right, to get at your content, right, which is about zero. This highlights an important feature of our model. All the work we do in IA will be for little, if not nothing, if it's distorted beyond recognition by the time it gets to the user. So where do we intervene? Let's move back through the model and see what can be done and where. Some organizations try and intervene here. Unfortunately, what usually happens is that you simply ensure that the experience will be bad. So this is the mobile website for greenchameleondesign.com. If you can't read that, it says, choosing your creative agency isn't like buying a pair of shoes. So why don't you make yourself comfy and visit our site on a real screen? Brad Frost, who tweeted this, had this to say about that experience. I can't be sure, but I'm guessing this isn't the quality a green chameleon was going after, right? Now, I wouldn't say that this drives me to acts of physical violence, but it is the mobile era equivalent of this, right? Most of us have learned that this is a shaky tactic at best. So let's move back down our stream. Now, we've already seen some cases where choreography can work, right, in responsive design. And there's also the case in native design where you actually articulate even more differently depending on the particular device prism in question. So we can look at choreography as something that can be split. Right? If you're designing for Android or iOS, you're going to have a different choreography depending on the needs of the device. What I want to get at is that if we stop here, at the choreography level, we're shortchanging ourselves. Taxonomy can also act as a point of articulation, a place where we can express ideas fluently and coherently. And that's the example that I'd like to look at. So again, to reiterate, a responsive IA is an information design strategy that facilitates the expression of specific meaning across multiple and independent contexts. For this example, I'm going to apply some of the concepts we've discussed around the responsive grid and around modes of signification to create something that I'm tentatively calling a taxonomic grid. And there are four basic steps here: determining our narrative, auditing content in existing organization, identifying and building single-dimension structures, and then articulating compound taxonomies to meet goals, accommodate constraints, and leverage opportunities. Now, for those of you that build the big IA taxonomies that help determine how a site is structured and how it's navigated, most of this will look pretty similar to what you're doing. But there are a couple key differences tied to how we understand information and how we articulate it that I want to call out here. And I'm going to do this by applying it to another organization for which I have a lot of admiration, 826 Seattle. 826 Seattle is a nonprofit writing center in my neighborhood in Seattle. Their goal is to help kids in the 6 to 18 age range improve their writing skills. And they do this with a healthy dose of whimsy, exuberance, and creativity. 826 is donor-funded. They're largely volunteer-led. Now, 826 did a site redesign in 2011, and the site you see here is that redesign. It's effective, it's attractive, it meets the goals the center has for it. It's not so prepared for the mobile context. This is about as good as you can get. Well, it's their site on a mobile phone. The goal for this exercise will be to think through what needs to happen at the taxonomic level to effectively articulate 826's specific meaning, their ontology, to mobile. And in the process, to think through how work at the taxonomic level is necessary to articulating a site's particular meaning effectively. So let's start with our first step, just determining the narrative. In general, this involves the standard things that we do for discovery, so stakeholder interviews, traffic analysis, user research. In the case of 826, I was fortunate enough to be able to talk to the associate director and look at some of their recent traffic stats. This is a project that I did just for this presentation. The other ones I wasn't able to share here. What I found in this conversation was that of their four main audiences, students, teachers, donors, and volunteers, the audience that was the most important for them for their website was the volunteers, because the website is how they reach and recruit their volunteers more than any other pathway. We can see how they do this on their desktop site by looking at how their structure is laid out. They have a secondary nav up here in the top that has volunteers in sort of that left-hand first spot. Front and center is a get involved link that goes right to the volunteer section. Then under the R programs, there's lots of information for how volunteers can get involved. Now, all this gave me, in thinking through this exercise, a basic idea of what they were going after, what they're working to achieve. From there, I audited their content and I looked at their existing organization, right? So kind of the standard things we would do. From here, from this content audit, I was able to reverse engineer the taxonomy as it was presented on their site. It's fairly broad, fairly shallow. And what I found was a multiple pathway structure. So they had several ways for people to get to base level content about volunteering and about being involved in the center, but pathways that didn't obscure the other paths for the different roles. Now, up to this point, it's been fairly standard, if not really, really lightweight, right? What I found in working in mobile and working with clients is this is usually where they come to me and say, great, you're done, get it on a device. If we stop here, we might end up with something that's pretty close to this. This would be a standard way to translate this site onto a mobile device. Where we'll have our nav, we can hide the global nav behind a little hamburger icon, and then we get our graphic header, features, programs. But we should ask, what's the argument we're making here? What's the qualia that the user experiences about this argument? Are we meeting the same goals? My answer, of course, is no, we're not, particularly when we consider the way the desktop was able to reach potential volunteers. Now, the desktop did that by using space, right, which we don't have here. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we have to choose between one or the other. Either we meet the goals of the desktop or we meet some other goal on mobile. For that matter, it's often not even the same goal. So I'll argue that we can make this more effective by re-examining our taxonomy. So let's go back to where we left off. If we want to build this taxonomy out to be a responsive kind of taxonomy, our first step is to fill in the missing pieces of the conceptual grid. Flesh out the way that users are making sense of the underlying organization, and to do this, go beyond how users are making sense in a strictly symbolic way. So here I actually broke the structure down into as many relationships and levels of granularity as I could think of based on the user's field of view. And the actual scope is a bit larger than what we initially saw. So what I've color-coded are the implied categorizations and relationship types of the existing taxonomy. And in this case, we had relationships based on activity, audience, category, hierarchy, location, and time. And here they're all intermixed. Right? And we see this on just about any site. I mean, nothing's really just one dimension. So from here, in order to think about how this translates, how this articulates into multiple contexts, the next step is to identify and build single dimension structures. Now in this case, when I'm talking about a dimension, I'm referring to a single, simple organizing principle. The goal of the single dimension is to tease out the range of possibility for the whole, but to tease it out one piece at a time. To pull out the single idea so that the pattern as a whole can perform more effectively. In this case, the individual dimensions are aligned for the most part with the original relationship types. So we have location and time. A simple way to map, is it during school, is it after school, is it on the weekends? Type of activity, so is it a school visit, is it a field trip? And then people and roles, students, parents, teachers, volunteers, and staff. I skipped over those quickly. This last one I'll go into a little more detail and look at the nuts and bolts. But the interesting thing here is, although it doesn't come out in this particular example, when I've done this on projects, we end up with a lot more dimensions than were initially present on the site. And they become sites of opportunity and places where we can say, hey, there's a whole new way that you can approach this that you'd never thought of because it wouldn't have worked on the desktop, right? Or it wouldn't have worked on wherever else you had implemented this website. So this is also the place where people tend to get tripped up. Because immediately they say, oh, this looks like facets. But there is a difference between this and facets in terms of purpose and approach. So while as facets are often a supplement to a goal-directed global nav and have fairly low predictability, this kind of grid is based on semantic organization and needs to carry an information scent based on particular meaning. The way we do that is by paying close attention to consistency and predictability in the elements of the grid. So in this case, it's parts of speech, register, tone, granularity, mode. These are the salient characteristics of our grid. And these are the patterns that speakers recognize, even though they can't identify them. This is what, to come back to the idea of the grid, this is what is the equivalent of our columns, rows, groupings, and associations. Now, just like Tufte, we're not going to present those in the final design. But if we have attention to them here, we don't need to. That's not the salient characteristic. It's the relationship that is. So this chart, if we start off with 826, and this is the role dimension. You can say that 826 is comprised of members of the community or the 826 organization, and that's national, who consume services as students, parents, or educators. So there's a consistency that operates all the way through this grid. And there's a level of granularity that's consistent as well. This is important because in the next step, we're going to use these dimensions to express a contextually articulated instance of this grid. So this is sort of the culminating moment in this taxonomy exercise, but it's deceptively simple. The idea is, based on what you know about the site's particular meaning and goals, and what you know about the constraints and opportunities of the prism in question, figure out a way to best combine the elements you've identified. So in this case, I've articulated a mobile taxonomy that is relatively narrow and deep, and I've subdivided concepts by activity at the first level, and then by category, more or less at the second level, and then intermixed in the third level, the role and location-specific relationships. This doesn't replace the desktop taxonomy, and you might have a separate one for the tablet. That's where the difference is here, is that in each case, we're articulating something that's specific to the context. And what that means is that the user's going to look at it in one place, right, and then look at it in another place, and be presented with information in a different order, but an order that is consistent and regular, because we built it that way, and that is optimized for the device that they're on. Now, in the case of 826, their site on mobile might look something like this, right, where we have our nav, and then instead of the features at the top, we have calls to action around learn and volunteer. And then about 826. Or it might look something like this, where we have headers and then activities and then get involved. In both cases, the taxonomic grid gives us a guideline to follow based on our site's content and based on how users perceive patterns. Now, this is where I'm going to end with this example. There's not a big reveal of how I fixed 826's mobile taxonomy. But their eventual approach, like all the approaches we do, will need to involve review and iteration, stakeholder input, testing. This specific example isn't the solution for the challenges of mobile, but is intended to be a practical tool for effective experiences that are flexible and adaptive and open to change. And it's this core of being flexible and open to change that brings me to my last point about responsive IA. Luca Rosati recently wrote that embracing ambiguity, embracing the possibility of not understanding exactly how the pieces fit together, means designing systems that surpass our expectations of them. Our systems, of course, are only going to get more complex. And though I've only looked at the web here, what I hope is that what you'll take away from this talk is insight into how we can apply the principles of modeling based on human perception to allow for the expression of specific meaning across multiple contexts. So in closing and to sum up, responsive IA is one that includes rich understanding, content-driven guidelines, articulated information structures, and embraces ambiguity as a strategy for negotiating the connected environment. And the goal of this approach, and I think it's a worthy one, is to hopefully create a future where the connected environment is a bit less like this and a little more like that. Thank you. Questions? Yes.
Hi. Can you explain more about what you mean by dimensions and the difference between that and ontology?
Oh, sure. So a dimension, and I'm not trying to be obscuring and using dimension, it's similar to the idea of a facet. So it's one way to look at a certain piece of data. The reason I pulled it out as a separate word is that I wanted to separate this idea from the idea of facets. So facets we build in order to help people get places. The idea of using a single dimension to organize is, the purpose is to organize concepts, right? Not necessarily help people get places, because what I've done with this and the few times that I've used it and what the goal is to be able to pull out individual pieces of each of those dimensions and then assemble them in a way that's appropriate for the particular context that you're working on. Now, you could look at the collection of all the different dimensions as an expression of an ontology. So the ontology, again, to quote Dan Klein, it's what we mean when we say what we say. It's your particular meaning, right? It's the argument that you have about your content. Did that answer the question? Okay.
You kind of mentioned it very quickly, but I wanted to know more about how do you deal with the content being restructured on a different platform, and maybe a user is, let's say, familiar with the structure on the desktop and he's looking for something maybe very quickly and he thinks that he would know where to find it, and then all of a sudden he's presented with a different structure.
Mm-hmm. That kind of question is what prompted me to think about how we can change this process or what the underlying process needs to be to think about structuring things differently. So I work in a space where I work on projects that are almost always responsive and articulated across different platforms. The request that we normally get is, you know, make it the same, make things in the same place. But what we see, and the reason that I use 826 as an example, is that as soon as you put all of the structural elements of the 826 desktop site onto a mobile phone, you've created a different story. Because of space constraints, you're forced to reorder the elements, and you're forced to put them in a different juxtaposition. Now, the reason that I went through the different modes of meaning making is to try and paint the idea that the words and their specific meaning is only one way that we make meaning in the world and on the web. That the juxtaposition of those ideas and the way that not only physically but conceptually they fall into a grid and we make those associations is another way that we make meaning. So the first answer to that question is, if someone says, no, I want it to be the same because you're looking for the same thing, often you won't be able to find it anyway, right? Because your meaning has been shaken up just by responding to the device, right? Unless you do something like just shrink the screen down, right? Which is then terrible because there are all sorts of usability problems there. The second piece is, if we look at native applications, we can get some cues, and that was another thing that tipped me off because I've done a fair amount of native work as well. We can get some cues into how people actually operate with this. So I'm one of these nerds that usually has both an iOS and an Android device on him, and I found that moving between them, you use Evernote on the two devices, for instance, and at a certain point, they were pretty wildly different, and they were respecting the navigation paradigms of each of the devices. In entering into each one of those, though, the user brings the context of their familiarity with the device and the familiarity with how it operates. So for native applications, when you have something that is usually built first on iOS and then just mapped over into Android, it's usually pretty messy and pretty broken, but it also leaves at the door all of the information that the user brings. Now, the web's a little bit different, right? Because across devices, our websites tend to look more or less the same. But when we're comparing the web on this machine to the web on a mobile device, we have a lot more options. And I guess the corollary to that is, if we take a mobile-first option and we say, well, we're going to start there and then we'll scale up to desktop, what we see when we have desktop sites where you now have the desktop site and there's the hamburger icon. Do you guys know what I mean? It's the three horizontal lines. The hamburger icon, and that reveals your navigation. And you've got this desktop site that's got all this white space, right? And it's got these huge spaces in it. Now, sometimes that's an aesthetic choice. It's a design choice, and it's great. But sometimes it's someone taking mobile, and now they're mapping the limitations and the constraints of mobile onto desktop and missing opportunities there in the same way that we miss them when we translate the other way. Does that answer your question? Or did I just talk a lot? Yeah, one of the reasons that I started with the idea of the responsive grid was to give people fuel to take back and say, like, hey, this thing that we understand is responsive grid, it's actually not just, you know, a monkey with a crayon drawing lines. There's another process behind it.
It's really hard not to try to think more about the practical example of 826 Seattle and think about how the grid could make the design better. And what your screen example seemed to be suggesting is that you could have multiple layouts depending on role.
Right.
And I was wondering, you know, that takes a special kind of technology in order to be able to do that. And I was wondering if that's a viable option for them.
Right. Thank you. I was not suggesting that there would be multiple layouts depending on role. I was suggesting that once we have a multidimensional taxonomy that is not the final product and are able to change that, to flex it, to make it responsive into something that's contextually appropriate, there are several different options available. Now, the purpose of this, and I don't know if it came out quite as well, is the idea that this is one way that we can create a system out of a taxonomy, is to have that sort of large pool of organization we can draw from and find the organization that works best. The reason I showed two screens was to show that there are multiple options available. Because this wasn't a project that I finished with 826, I didn't have the input necessary, right, because I can't do all this on my own, to decide which one of those is best. But it wouldn't be a case where I would suggest that they do a multiple roles entry point, because then that's a different kind of story than they're telling on desktop. That's a different kind of scope of project. Thanks for that. I think we're out of time, actually. Thank you.
The 2014 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by UIE's All You Can Learn. UIE's All You Can Learn will give you the skills and techniques you need for a competitive design advantage with 24/7 access to UX experts and topics. For more information, visit aycl.uie.com. That's aycl.uie.com. As always, thank you for listening.